Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Just a little over 8 hours ago, Joseph R. Biden was sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. The S&P 500 posted the best inauguration day rise in 36 years as Biden takes office. The Nasdaq chalked up its best inauguration day gain ever. Trump likes to boast about the size of his inauguration day crowds and how the stock market performed during his presidency, but this is one metric he clearly did not win. In fact, you'd have to go back to the 1980s and the start of Ronald Reagan's second term to find a better first day market rise. It's all about business for Joe Biden, the 46th U.S. president, taking the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord in a break with Trump, putting COVID and the masking, the need for masks, front and center. All business for Biden. There are concerns, though, over taxes, minimum wage as well. We're going to take a closer look at Biden and markets with my guest today, Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Good morning, Arun.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you very much for having me.
Always a joy. So what do you read from day one of Biden's work? A number of executive orders signed, some 17. What are you reading?
I mean, as you mentioned, the Paris Climate Agreement, Biden decided the U.S. is going to rejoin WHO, end of the Keystone XL pipeline. Because of this whole COVID pandemic, you know, extend eviction moratoriums, pause in loan payment for students, et cetera, et cetera. So all basically very expected items of what he was claiming throughout his run for presidency the last 6 to 9 months. And I think that's like the key to this entire thing, right? Where you have expected actions and policies. No more crazy market moves at 2 a.m. based on what Trump is tweeting or the whole flurry of tweets that he has typically. It's predictability, and markets love that. So from the aspect that, you know, the entire government side of things, if they can just be kept as steady as what they used to be, except for the last 4 years, that is, we can get back to letting like the economic powerhouse of the U.S., the capital structure that's been set up, the system, do its job as it has been phenomenally well for the last 200 years. So it's kind of like, you know, coming back to reality and going back to business as usual, which is fantastic for markets. And we kind of saw that yesterday. The tax angle is something that we will have to see how it plays out over the course of the next 6 months or 1 year. But, you know, taxing a little bit more on the rich, which most of them have been more than happy to do so, while trying to support the underprivileged and reducing that massive wealth disparity that's going on in the U.S. and, for that matter, many other countries, is something that will be beneficial in the long run for society and hence the markets.
What do you make, though, of what China's done? I mean, sort of having the last laugh, so to speak, saying no to, you know, big name U.S. politicians from visiting China. I wonder if you caught that piece of news at all.
I didn't, but, you know, in this game, China will always have the advantage considering there's no four-year term presidency. Right. But what I hope will happen, though, at least, is China realizing fully well that now there's a more, quote unquote, potentially stable U.S. government, mm-hmm. and a person that they're dealing with will, you know, adopt the more diplomatic means of communication, the way to go about doing the day-to-day processes. One would hope that China's also going to extend the olive branch and they're going to be able to try and work together. I think it'll still be difficult given that the whole anti-China sentiment that's there in the U.S. is across the aisle, not just Republicans, but Democrats too. But, you know, one would hope that the way that they go about dealing with China is going to be different, and hence you might be able to see some kind of a stronger partnership.
Yeah, so I was referring to what we see in terms of China, the Beijing administration imposing sanctions on several top officials of the Trump administration, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former U.S. Trade Advisor Peter Navarro, Trump Advisor Steve Bannon, John Bolton, and whether, you know, we can expect to see sort of a ramping up of the tit-for-tat between China and the U.S. But broadly speaking, we heard Janet Yellen giving a testimony, and some say that underscored the tone and tenor of the U.S.-China relationship going forward. Did you see any signals there?
Well, I mean, I heard the speech, and she made it very clear, right, that they will continue to adopt a very tough stance in China. Absolutely. Yep. Like the whole undercutting American companies through, be it illegal subsidies, dumping of products, theft of IP, barrier to U.S. goods, all of, you know, very, very similar terminology that was used by Trump and his administration seems to be continuing when Janet Yellen was speaking, and some things that Biden has said also. But again, I think it's not about what the, obviously, you know, the underlying crux of the issue is a big concern, but I think it's very important about how they go about trying to resolve this issue. Mm-hmm. And the way at least Biden and Yellen have come out saying it's going to be more of working with allies, adopting a more diplomatic approach to this, not taking unilateral decisions and just slapping a whole bunch of tariffs on $100 billion worth of Chinese import goods last minute, and all of these, this ding-donging approach that really did not work well for the market. And for that matter, it really didn't work well from the China perspective, because the whole losing the face concept is something that's really important to them. And they know that they can play the long game a lot easier than the U.S. that has to have elections every 4 years. So I think from all of those perspectives, we will continue to see or a more rational approach to setting tariffs or not, and reaching out across to China in a sensible and smart and diplomatic way, which is something that we were not seeing the last 4 years. Another thing that Janet Yellen said that I found to be quite interesting was taking quite a dovish approach to the whole long-term debt. And, you know, everyone knows that, you know, the whole long-term debt situation in the U.S. is at a potentially, like, in the danger zone. But her coming out saying, look, the priority for the country right now is to defeat the pandemic first. Once that's done, once we help, especially the unemployed and small businesses, that is when we can get back on track to figure out about the debt issue, worry about the longer term problems. And for that, she said that Biden and her had a very strong plan on U.S. investments into infrastructure, on into research and development. And I think those are the two key sectors that will have a huge tailwind on the back of the Democrats sweeping the House, the Senate, and of course, the White House.
Yes, Janet Yellen making a very strong case for additional stimulus relief, particularly for those most in need, coupled with this idea of expanding unemployment insurance, saying that this is going to give Americans the biggest bang for their buck. This will have the biggest economic impact, so to speak. I want to touch a little bit about a topic that we sort of skirted around here and there when we talk about stimulus, and that is this whole idea of inflation. You know, some analysts we speak with speak of possible hyperinflation in the years ahead. And then I came across a great book by investor and author Mark Mobias, which persuasively argues that everything we know about inflation today does not reflect reality any longer, because he says technology is leading to goods and services being cheaper, so to speak, or being more affordable. So he argues that inflation is an unreliable metric for several reasons, including the debasement of currencies following monetary printing. So broadly, Arun, is inflation still a useful metric when we talk about regulating monetary supply?
Now that's a very loaded question. So I listened to a whole bunch of interviews by Mark on various shows. I sadly did not have the time to read his book yet, but, you know, all his previous books and the stuff that he writes is truly phenomenal reading. So coming from one of the pioneer experts in the emerging markets, it really is a must read for all your listeners who invest into, you know, maybe not just Singapore itself, but anywhere around the Asian region. Coming to his, you know, what he was saying, I actually do think it makes a lot of sense, right? His whole premises that technology is what is causing deflation, and that is through extreme amounts of productivity enhancements, which is very different from a lack of demand. And I think one of his examples that he brings about saying, everyone knows the iPhone comes out with a new product every year, right? Mm-hmm. But does that mean that iPhone 4 had poor sales or iPhone 7 had poor sales? Not at all. The fact that technology is improving at such a dramatic pace, and even though the old technology product might be getting devalued in nature, every company needs to be able to embrace technology to ensure that they can keep coming out with a better, stronger product, which people will additionally buy. So from his perspective, what he's saying is because of the general, like the growth in the world and people earning more money, people being happy to spend more money on goods, they're able to do it and buy goods on an annual basis, which is actually good for specifically for companies that are able to embrace technology. So from that perspective, like gone are the days, you know, when you knew that a television, say back in Japan, you knew a television is going to become cheaper every 6 months or every year.
Yeah.
Then what does the consumer do? Right? You just step back. Thank you very much. I'll wait for 2-3 years. But now you know that this is really cool technology right now. Okay, it's at a decent price. I'll buy it. In a year's time, I know the same TV might be cheaper, but there will be a new television out there with much better technology that I will also want to buy. So the ability of companies to convince consumers to continuously deploy capital to purchase their goods by providing them a value add, I think that is the key metric here. And that is something that many companies have been able to achieve. So while there might be deflation in the traditional sense of the definition, where you kind of have a certain good and you evaluate how much money you spend on that good, how much money do you spend on that last year versus this year as a percentage of your income, that concept is kind of gone, which I do agree with. That being said, though, from the broader perspective, having so much free capital sloshing around, it's inevitable that that capital has to be deployed in certain areas. And we are seeing that currently in terms of asset growth or potentially even an asset bubble in certain sectors of the equity markets, definitely in fixed income, certain property markets, including coming back to Singapore, where there'll be potentially more, tightening measures on property price increases. So you're seeing all these bubbles getting created. And I don't think it's that easy to know where the bubble will get created, obviously, as we can see currently, but especially when that bubble can pop too. So I think it's a combination of all of these factors that investors or prudent investors should always be looking out for.
So I was thinking about this in light of that $1.9 trillion relief proposal that we were just talking about, right, in the U.S., because also in the Financial Times recently, we had a great article from Wharton professor Jeremy Siegel on inflation prospects. And he says, and I quote, the multi-trillion dollar war on COVID was not paid for by higher taxes or bond sales to the public. There is no such thing as a free lunch. It will be the Treasury bondholders through rising inflation who will be paying for the unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus over the past year. So what do you think of Jeremy Siegel's argument? I mean, it's from Wharton on inflation prospects and worrying about, you know, the erosion of the risk mitigation potential of government bonds.
I mean, that's the thing, right? 100% agree with that. You have two extremely smart people on either side of the spectrum, and it's just the nature of financial markets and in a time which is never been experienced by the world in the past, like, 200 years. Never have we seen interest rates to be remaining so low, yet at the same time, inflation not having been created. Now, sure, technology does play a massive role in that, no doubt. So I'll give that to the Mark Mobius side of the camp, no doubt. But on the other side, you know, traditional economics, where you just have so much capital, I am definitely not a fixed income investor, but I just cannot see the rationale of $17 trillion worth of negative interest rate bonds, I cannot see the rationale of potentially buying like a 30-year U.S. Treasury bond right now at like 2%, 2.5% interest. It just, you know, just doesn't make sense on a risk-reward perspective. So from that angle, as an investor into capital markets, mm-hmm. I think the fixed income side, the asset class, is in just in such a massive bubble. Again, just there's just so much capital sloshing around. It has to go into certain asset classes. And from the perspective of principal protection, that's pretty much the only game out there left to play.
All right, let's switch gears, Arun. Let's take a look at oil. The UAE, the Saudis have been propping up oil prices. It cut shipments to Asia and Europe. What else have we seen? ANZ Bank seeing oil stabilizing at $60 in the second half of this year. What is your outlook for oil for 2021?
I'm actually a little bit more in the bullish camp for oil. And the rationale for that is, firstly, you know, a lot more geopolitical calm, which mm-hmm. is extremely important, especially with the Saudis and Iran and all of that stuff. I think another big role in this will be the rollout of the COVID vaccine. I think, again, you know, coming to what Charlie Munger was saying a while back, the ability for companies to mass produce this and distribute it out is going to be phenomenal, right? The amount of capital and the smartest of the smart PhDs and research and development people were even able to create a vaccine in the short time frame of 8 months with this whole working from home issues and other logistical issues is truly phenomenal, right? It's like massive kudos to governments and the pharma companies across the globe to enable this to happen. Now, it's obviously going to be a bit of a logistics issue, but I think we will be able to get through this. And that, coupled with a huge lack of capital investments in this space over the past 3 to 5 years, I think we will see oil appreciating quite substantially from this point. In addition to all of that, potential US dollar weakness against currencies because of the fact that the Fed has clearly come out saying that they're going to be keeping interest rates basically zero for the next couple of years. Whereas on the other hand, we are seeing some amount of growth coming out of China, some amount of growth coming out from the ASEAN region as a whole, mm-hmm. I think will lead to a good demand for oil, debasement to some extent of the US dollar, the vaccine rollout. So all of those different rationales put together, I think on a risk-reward perspective, oil definitely has a decent leg up to move.
So we saw gold prices bouncing from an upward sloping trend line near 1825. As the U.S. inaugurated a new president, we saw risky assets moving higher, and that helped buoy gold prices as well. We've had several analysts on the show saying they're quite bullish about gold and silver this year. What is your forecast for gold?
Silver, completely agree with. Mm-hmm. I think there are industrial uses for that. And this is just going to be like metals and commodities in general, I would say. So from that perspective, yes, I don't invest directly into silver or the underlying ETFs regarding it, but I can see various rationales similar to that of oil as to why we could see, you know, the silver price appreciate. Regarding gold, I think, you know, we've talked about this a number of times on your show. Mm-hmm. There are just so many opposing factors to, is it like a risk off play? Is it a risk on play? Is it an inflation hedge? Is it only related to the US dollar weakness as a way to play that? I think there are so many differing factors over there. It becomes very difficult to predict the price action in gold. So I personally just take a step back and happy to read about it, but mm-hmm. Don't get involved in that space myself.
All right. Investment bank Goldman Sachs picked mining and metal stocks as that which will benefit from a commodity super cycle. Goldman Sachs said the last super cycle happened in the mid-2000s during a housing bubble that resulted in the credit crisis. Aaron, what is this new super cycle? Why are commodity prices surging in 2021?
So a super cycle, I'm not sure what the theoretical definition is, but a super cycle basically means when there is a long-term trend in certain underlying groups of materials, which tends to be, the price appreciation of that basket of goods tends to be quite a bit higher than what the previous 5 to 10 years trends were, which basically is another way for saying that this is a group of underlying goods, in this case, metals or commodities, whose price will appreciate quite significantly for the next 5 to 10 years. And that's something that we've seen in various cycles, right? Like be it the mid-2000s, thanks to China, going back to like the 1990s, pre the dot-com bust. Typically, these groups of metals or underlying commodities tends to appreciate in like lock sync. So from that perspective, coming to this specific thesis of Goldman, I actually completely agree with it. I think the amount of government stimulus, which will hopefully lead to a fuller employment, as well as, most importantly, increased income for the lower economic strata of society, who tend to spend a higher percentage of their wealth in buying goods, potentially moving into a new house. This COVID pandemic has led people to, be living in your own space a little bit more comfortably if you can afford it. I think it is going to be one big driving factor for the demand for these materials. So on the one hand, you have potentially a much higher demand where with the vaccination release, you're going to start seeing China and Asia especially are going to be the beacons of growth for the world. I hope that the U.S. will be able to, get its act together now with this masking policy, with a more stable government. So hopefully over the next couple of years, we'll start seeing underlying economic growth in the U.S., not just the stock market, but actual underlying growth. And you couple that surge in demand, I would say, with a potential lack of ability of supply to ramp up as quickly, because, again, the whole capital expenditure in these sectors had taken quite a beating in the last 5 years, post the hangover of the previous super cycle. Mm. So I think that combination of increase of demand with lack of supply being able to ramp up quickly will lead to the price appreciation of this basket of underlying goods.
Well, just wonderful speaking with you. Thank you for giving so much context and perspective to market news for us, Arun. Thank you so much.
My pleasure as always. Thank you for having me once again, Michelle.
He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. I want you to stay with us on Money and Me because coming up right here on this show pretty soon, we will have Mark Mobius himself talking about the inflation myth and the wonderful world of deflation, his new book. Stay with us.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg. Or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.